This is part two of the Anne Heron murder. You can listen to part one on the podcast Scottish Murders. In this episode, we hear from Dawn from Scottish Murders, Anne Heron's son Ralph, and former journalist Chris Webber. We did an in-depth interview with Peter Heron and with Anne's daughter Anne Marie in 2015, the 25th anniversary of Anne Heron's murder. At 8 a.m. that morning, six police officers came to a house in Wilshaw near Huddersfield, where Peter Heron was now living, and arrested the then 70-year-old for Anne's murder. Peter was taken to Spennymoor Police Station in County Durham. At the station, Peter refused a solicitor and said he had nothing to hide, and answered all the questions put to him by detectives. Though eventually one of Peter's daughters did organise a solicitor for her father. Police argued the motive for Anne's murder was the affair Peter was having with the barmaid Amelia. They believed Peter was not being truthful about his whereabouts on the afternoon Anne was killed, and that he had more than enough time to have committed the murder. Investigators believe Peter was behind the wheel of the speeding Mercedes, seen driving erratically at around 3:50 to 3:55 p.m. They had faith in the witnesses who said they had seen Peter in his car. One witness said they got a close enough look to see the driver's false teeth swishing around their mouth. Peter repudiated all of this and pointed out that he didn't even have false teeth. He stuck by his 1990 statement that he had been in a meeting with Cleveland Bridge employees at this time. Peter said he was in a meeting from 3:50 to 4:20 p.m. If you remember, the time he said he arrived at Cleveland Bridge is either 3:15 p.m, as stated in the Northern Echo in 2015, or 3:45 p.m, as stated in the Channel 5 documentary. The police maintained that Peter had the time and opportunity to have committed the murder. They then played their trump card. They now confirmed that DNA evidence had been obtained from Anne's body in 1990. The family had been told of this at the time, but it was not made public. The DNA was from a minuscule amount of semen found in Anne's throat. Through technological advancements, the semen was now shown to belong to Peter Heron. Peter and his legal team were dubious as to why, after 15 years, this piece of evidence was suddenly produced. But even if it was his, Peter argued, of course, his DNA would be all over the scene, as Anne was his wife. Many people, including journalist Kevin Donald, have since expressed surprise that Peter was charged with Anne's murder based on this DNA sample. Still, that is what happened, and Peter was charged with Anne's murder in a magistrate's court on November 11, 2005. He was placed in custody and spent a week in home prison before being granted bail. The Heron family staunchly stood behind Peter. They thought the premise that Peter had killed his then wife was ridiculous, as he had no reason to do it. Peter went to stay with his daughter Debbie, and together with his legal team, they began preparing for the upcoming trial. Then, just as suddenly, it was all over. One day in February 2006, Peter opened the front door to find a group of reporters on his doorstep. They were there to get his reaction to the news that the case against him was being dropped. The Crown Prosecution Service had decided not to continue with the prosecution.
I kept in quite close touch with the police. Obviously, there was a family liaison officer. And the police, they clearly knew that I worked in the CID, I'd worked in murder investigations. So there was a bit there that I didn't want to overstep the line because I knew I could compromise anything that they did. They didn't clearly want to overstep that line as well. So I was kept informed, but probably no more than anybody else would have been. However, when they told me that Peter had been arrested initially, huge relief that finally something's happened. I drove down to Darlington. So I was living in Luss, the Loch Lomond side of the town. So I drove down to Darlington. I think Anne Marie came with us as well. And we went to see the police at Durham And I remember speaking to the police at Durham. I can't remember. It wasn't Keith Redman at that time. I can't remember who it was. But whoever the SIO was told us, I said, so what have you got? What evidence have you got? And they told me what evidence they had. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I ain't going to convict them. Surely they're holding something back from me and they're not telling me something, which would be perfectly normal and acceptable and something that I wouldn't particularly challenge at that point. But it appeared that, you know, when it did appear at court, and it appeared to me that they didn't have any more than they said they had. So had he gone to trial and what they had, I doubt very much. In fact, I'm sure that he wouldn't have been. You can't be sure. I'm almost sure that he wouldn't have been convicted on the evidence that they had at that point.
Commented on the decision to drop the case, Anson Ralph, who was a police officer, said from a professional viewpoint, it was the correct decision, as there wasn't enough evidence presented to warrant a trial. Anne's daughter, Anne Marie, has since said she was not surprised when the prosecution collapsed. While many defendants would welcome this news, at the time, Peter said he was disappointed. He wanted his day in court to prove his innocence and put a stop to the rumours and whispers that had followed him over the last 15 years. Peter's legal team believed that many would continue to think Peter had committed the murder and the case against him may have only been dropped on a legality. They feared the cloud of suspicion would remain. Over the last two decades, the Heron family have campaigned for Peter's innocence to be recognised. Peter's daughter Debbie spearheaded a drive to change people's perception of her father. Through her work, Debbie uncovered information which eventually led to an official complaint being made. When preparing for trial, Debbie was given the police files on the case, which contained the evidence they had against her father. She was shocked by how little they had. Speaking in the 2022 Channel 5 documentary, Debbie said Peter's arrest was in part due to a document written by a forensic analyst just 6 days prior. It was written by the same person who had completed a report in 1990, 2 days after the murder. It seems that this person had now come to a new conclusion, which put forward an explanation as to why no blood was found on Peter or his clothing. The exact details of this have not been made public, but it was one of the factors that led to a formal complaint being made by the family about how the case was handled by the police. Other reasons cited in the complaint concerned the way the crime scene was handled. According to Peter, both the paramedics and the first police officer on the scene moved the body. Another major cause for concern for the family was the way the investigation had focused on Peter to the detriment of discovering the identity of the man driving the blue car.
I don't think I necessarily agree with that, though, because, I mean, what did they have? 100,000 police man hours and was it 5,000 statements taken? I think they didn't just go down blinkered. I think it's, to me, obviously as an outsider, they did a lot.
They did, well, I've read the stats a while ago, didn't I, in terms of the 5,000 lines of inquiry.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Almost 4,000 statements taken. So yeah, from my research going through, they did a really thorough job going through lots of different angles, looking for the cars, but they just didn't come up with a lot of concrete stuff, basically. It eluded them. For whatever reason.
I can understand why Peter's frustrated, obviously, because he's been stuck in limbo all this time, can't go forward, can't go back. So I can understand why he's saying they haven't done their job, but maybe in regards to that, they haven't. But I think in general, it sounds like they have.
It's a man who is incredibly frustrated. That's what it feels like. Yeah. And just feels he's in a corner.
Yeah.
In April 2022, the Independent Office for Police Conduct ordered Durham Constabulary to investigate the complaint, which, as I said, centred around the belief that police dismissed Peter's alibi and focused on the narrative that he was the killer, ignoring evidence to the contrary. The complaint, however, was thrown out in December 2022. Peter Heron says he has found it impossible to get on with his life even after charges were dropped against him in February 2006. He feels his reputation was completely torn to shreds. Speaking in the Daily Record in August 2023, the now 88-year-old said he wants the Durham Constabulary publicly to say he is no longer a suspect. He is calling for an independent investigation into Anne's murder and is campaigning for a judicial review to completely exonerate him.
I was just a local reporter. I'd gone back into reporting kind of lower down than when I'd left it. I'd done all different kinds of journalism, but I'd gone back to the local paper kind of for personal reasons. The kind of journalism I enjoyed most was feature writing, where you might get a bit of a few more words, you know, to try to really get behind the story and try to get a sense of what people are like, a bit like you probably do yourself, but by writing. And I was really interested in that. And so one of my many bosses, Chris Lloyd, he asked me to do it. He gave me the assignment to follow up, because it was the 25th anniversary. And I mean, I was excited to do the story because I'm from Darlington. I remembered the story, and it's quite a small town. And for example, my sisters went to school, I think, with one of Peter Barron's, or at the same school, didn't know each other. But it's such a small town that people know. Do you know, everybody on some level knows everybody there. But still, a murder like that is rare. You know, it's very, very, very rare. So I knew I'd known the story anyway. You know, I knew all about it, really, you know. The breakthrough was an interview with Peter Heron, husband of Anne, who had been accused of murder. He had spoken, but at a kind of a press conference many years ago. He'd never given, unless I'm remembering it wrong, but I don't think he'd ever given a one-to-one interview. His daughter, Debbie, had, and Debbie had been a strong campaigner on behalf of her dad. So she'd given interviews. So that was really important, I think, to get his side of the story in his own words. Because you have to remember, a lot of people, armchair detectives, who don't know what they're talking about, who just, you know, oh, it'll be the husband. And that's something to be extreme, as whether you do it for a living, it's something to be extremely careful of. So I could understand that. And I was excited to do it as a kind of news journalist. The first thing to do was to go and meet Debbie and Peter at her house in a Swiss village just to the north of Stockton, in a lovely house. And that was quite something. We did video that, and we did have quite an in-depth interview. And there were all the documents and all of the actions they were taking with the police at that time and had taken. So there was a lot of quite, I won't say mundane, but quite factual talk of going through the whole thing. And then we sat down and had an interview with Peter. And again, Peter was quite a charming man. He's a man of a certain generation. So he wasn't going to be tears and, you know, wailing at the wall. I won't say reserves the wrong word, because he was forthcoming, but he was a man of his generation. You could kind of tell he'd be a successful businessman. He was quite a charming man, and he spoke very well. I got the impression he was there for Debbie, really. I did get that impression, because Debbie's, he was there for himself and for Anne. Of course he was. But I got the impression, if it wasn't for Debbie, this interview wouldn't have happened, if that makes sense, you know. I mean, he had things he wanted to say, but he wanted, Debbie was so, you know, she loves her dad, and she wants to be cleared. And they've put up with all kinds of people. And don't forget, they were young when it happened. So you go to a nightclub or whatever, your dad's this, and, you know, And all that kind of thing. And it was a big anniversary, and he spoke very well. And I think I got the more emotional side of the story and what it meant to that family from Debbie, as I recall. And I'd like to say this, from doing that kind of reporting over a long time and covering court cases and the whole business, I often think, suppose Peter was a murderer, and he isn't, you know, but in any family where somebody has committed a terrible crime, and again, Peter, I'm not saying Peter did, they are forgotten. The family of that person didn't do anything wrong. They get untold, you know, they are victims too. Do you know what I mean? In this case, it's not just Peter, the whole family had to deal with this accusation. So I got a bit of emotion from Debbie there. She's a reserved woman and a very intelligent woman, as I remember, as I was, you know, as I as she seemed. I don't pretend to know her, but that when I met her that day, I just could tell it really, she wanted her dad cleared. Do you know what I mean? She was quite, I could tell the emotion was there with Debbie. It's not a common interview to have that, really. It's usually outside the court or, you know, or you might get a letter or, do you know what I mean? It's, it was quite an unusual, and they usually just want to forget, you know? So, but because there was this opinion, you know, this misguided opinions, you know, so it was quite an unusual interview to have. It was quite contained, but they got what they wanted to say and they both came across as articulate, nice people. The person I really wanted to speak to, and I did manage to get hold of, was Anne-Marie, or any of Anne's children, really. But Anne-Marie was the one I ended up in touch with. And I always wanted to speak to the victim. She just wants the murder solved, as they all do. So I was really interested to speak to her when she said she'd come down to Darlington. It was an anniversary. It's a big anniversary. She was a lovely, lovely person. And it was so hard for her. So she shows up to the train station. She gets picked up by somebody she doesn't know. I can't exactly remember the details about how it happened. To talk about the horrific death of her mother 25 years ago and go to the house where that happened. What a strange, strange experience for her. And then I got in touch with the owners of the house, which was then a cattery, if memory serves. And they were lovely too. And so that was quite a moment to go into the house and into the room where Anne was found with her Maria daughter. It was quite a moment. It wasn't as draining as emotional as I thought it would be, which is a really good thing. Because it was all there. The emotion was all there for Anne-Marie. But it wasn't. She kept it together. And the couple who ran the home were so kind and were so chatty. And it kind of kept it so that Anne-Marie could talk and get to what she wanted to say, you know, and have the photographs taken and all the rest of it. It was still just photographs, then it'd be video now. That sounds like we'd want the tears and everything. But I didn't really. I wanted Anne-Marie just to be able to say what she wanted to say.
Anne-Marie spoke to me about going there. She told me that she was going. She'd been there more than once now. And the sort of people that now own it, I think Anne-Marie's been in contact with, because it's now a pet sanctuary or a kennels or something like that. And Anne-Marie clearly thought that was quite fitting because my mum loved animals. And she went to see the house. And Anne-Marie said to me afterwards that although it was the house, it just felt completely different to what it had been before. I was actually training up in Darlington for the last 2 years. I've been up in Darlington every month and training investigators up there. And the last occasion I was up there, I drove by A.O. Lane House and I sat in the lay-by just next to it. And it just looked completely different. There's a new road, there's a new roundabout with new buildings around about it. So it's just completely different. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's it, really. You know, we ran the story over 3 days. This is how big a story it is in the community I'm from. It filled up the paper for 3 days, if I'm right, if I remember it right. After the stories came out, there was a reaction. And not just that these people leaving messages. I mean, people getting in touch with the newspaper. I remember people who said they'd saw somebody suspicious. And you know, we followed them all up. I did a couple of stories out of it. People saying they saw a suspicious man in the shoe and they went into a shop and the shoe, it was him and all this. Which I reported. So it was there for if there was anything in it.
So we'll come back to Peter shortly. And in a moment, we're going to look at other suspects that have been put forward in this case. They centre around the man in the blue car, seen driving at speed away from Aeolian House. Just before I get into that, I'll mention here a piece of information that surfaced 20 years after the murder, because if true, it certainly throws up two potential persons of interest. According to unsolvedmurders.co.uk, in 2010, a lorry driver came forward to say on the afternoon of Friday, August 3rd, 1990, they had seen Anne in a car turning into the driveway of Aeolian House from the main road. This was at 4:15 p.m. The lorry driver said Anne was driving the car and there was someone in the passenger seat who was leaning forward with their arms on the dashboard. The lorry driver also made out another backseat passenger. This sighting has never been confirmed. The woman the lorry driver saw was wearing clothes, not a bikini, as Anne had been wearing a bikini when she was last seen at 3:30 p.m. and was found dead wearing the upper part of the bikini. Police were sceptical of this sighting, and I can't really comment any more of this. Police just don't seem to put much weight in it. Looking at some of the suspects that have come up, in April 1997, the Times newspaper reported that a convicted rapist, 29-year-old Philip Hann, was being questioned in connection with Anne's murder. In 1994, Hann was sent to prison for a minimum of 12 years for one rape and two serious sexual assaults in Hartlepool. Hartlepool is about a 40-minute drive from Darlington. These attacks happened in 1991, 1993 and 1994 and showed Hann to be a cruel and violent offender. His last assault saw him drag a 19-year-old woman into a driveway as she walked home from college. He put a balaclava over her face, held a knife to her throat, and held a brick above her head. He sexually assaulted her and then raped her twice. Due to his violent history and the fact he lived in the Northeast, I can see why Philip Hann was looked at, though nothing ever came of this line of inquiry. As a side note, Philip Hann was released from prison in 2018, but in May 2021 struck again, attacking a woman on the Tees Barrage in Middlesbrough. The woman fought him off and Hann fled. He was soon captured and is currently back behind bars. In 2015, a woman came forward and told of a strange encounter she had witnessed in a card shop way back in late 1992 or early 1993. I've also seen the date given as 1991. A man had come into the shop where the woman worked as an assistant and inquired about some orders he wished to place. The man was directed to go into the back room to speak with the shop manager. Shortly after, the man left the shop with an odd smirk on his face. Moments later, the shop manager emerged from the back room, visibly shaken. She said during their conversation, the man had boasted about being the killer of Anne Herron. Although the manager was disturbed by what the man had said, she did not inform the police of this encounter, as she believed he was just trying to scare her. In 2015, the woman who was the shop assistant saw a news feature about Anne's murder and learnt about the description of the suntanned, dark-haired man seen driving away from the scene in a blue car. She said this matched the description of the man she remembered coming into the card shop. The woman has claimed that she went to the police with this information, but was never spoken to at length about the issue. In response to this, the police said they did speak to the woman and did look into the matter further.
I was curious about this. Do you know where the card shop was? Was it in the area or was it somewhere else?
I don't know. I meant to find that out today. And I don't think it was noted. I'm guessing it was in the Northeast because they obviously knew about the murder because they said she obviously remembered the name. I think they must have heard of the murder. Like, it was nationwide news, but I just wonder whether it was. I'm guessing it was in the area.
Yeah, you're right, because she mentioned that she thought they'd just boasting, so they must have, yeah, you're right, they must have known who Anne was. Just find that awful strange that
it is
somebody
odd.
Would just go into a shop and
say that. I mean, yeah, I mean, again, we don't know if that has anything to do with the murder, whether it was someone just being odd and sick. No one's ever got to the bottom of it. In 2016, the Herron family were contacted by independent cold case investigator Jen Jarvey, a university lecturer in public procedure. She offered to work for free on Anne's case and ended up winning the Zena Scott Archer Investigator of the Year Award for her work. Jen firmly believes that Peter Herron could not have committed the crime, as his timings and movements that afternoon just don't make it possible. She came up with a few potential suspects, with one in particular gaining traction. Jen believed that whoever had committed the murder was comfortable going into a stranger's home. She had a hunch that the person may have a history of burglary and decided to see if any similar crimes had happened around the same time. As research, Jen watched an episode of BBC's Crime Watch TV programme, which first aired a month after Anne's murder. It featured the story of Michael Benson. Benson had escaped from a prison in Hampshire in 1989 and was on the run. He had been serving a sentence for attempted murder and wasn't recaptured until 1999. Benson was known to drive a blue Ford Orion, not dissimilar to the car spotted at the Herons' house, and had been involved in violent knife crime in the past. Although Benson was from the south of England, he had relatives in Leeds, in the north of England, an hour and 15 minutes' drive south of Darlington. Benson matched the description of the dark-haired, suntan man seen driving away from Aeolian House. He was also similar in appearance to a man who had attacked two women at knife point near the River Weir in Durham on July 18, 1990, just a few weeks before Anne's murder.
So Jen had come to me with the Benson thing. Jen had been to me a couple of times with various, because she'd been, I think she had looked at my mum's case as part of her master's degree. So she then got in touch with me and she came up with a couple of different hypotheses. We spoke at length about some of them. There were some that were, you know, looked reasonable and certainly warranted some further investigation. But I guess the most credible one that she had come up with was the Benson one. So there were various aspects about that that I thought, if we didn't eliminate Benson, even if it wasn't him, if he wasn't eliminated, then he could be used as a defence by whoever was eventually arrested for it. So that was the reason that I wanted Benson looked at and eliminated, or we could prove that it was him. I think Donna Jen's angle was to exonerate Peter from the inquiry.
Unfortunately, Michael Benson could not be questioned, as he had passed away in 2011 from complications resulting from diabetes. Anne's son Ralph Coburn went with Jen Jarvie to the police to share with them the information about Benson. Jen Jarvie has gathered additional circumstantial evidence that she says points to Benson as Anne's killer. In 2020, after Anne's murder was featured in a news report, an ex-cellmate of Benson's, known only as Mick, came forward to share his story. Mick recognised Michael Benson as a man he had been in prison with. While they were both serving time in home prison in the northeast of England, Mick had mentioned to Benson that he had once been involved in a fight and had used a Stanley knife. Benson really liked hearing this story, and in return told Mick he had once cut someone up with a Stanley knife after jumping over their garden fence. Mick claimed that Benson had told him he had killed a woman living in an isolated house in Darlington. He had been in the area driving around looking to burgle a property and had thought this large house was an easy target. Mick now thought Benson had been referring to the murder of Anne Herron. Some doubted that what Mick had shared was the truth, including fellow inmates who had served time with Benson. They suspected Mick was hoping for a reward in exchange for talking. Nevertheless, Mick provided a signed statement to police and declared that he was not interested in receiving any monetary reward for the information he had given. Jen Jarvie also spoke with Benson's ex-wife, Ruth, and showed her copies of the taunting letters purportedly sent by the killer in 1994. Ruth said it was Benson's handwriting. It's important to say here that Durham police officially ruled out Benson in May 2017, not long after he was first touted as a potential suspect by Jen Jarvie. They say there is no evidence Benson was anywhere near the location, and they are almost certain he was living abroad at the time. Durham police are quoted in various news sources, such as Teesside Live in May 2022, as saying Michael Benson is not and never has been a suspect in Anne Herron's murder.
That's just quite disappointing, I think, wasn't it? Because he seemed quite viable for a while, you know, everything that I was reading about what Jen had come up with.
Yeah, it was a well thought out theory, but the police seemed quite quick to dismiss it, didn't they? They don't seem to have changed their mind on that at all. So, I mean, they've obviously got access to stuff that we don't, and they're obviously pretty sure that he wasn't in the area at the time. Over the last few years, another name has been put forward as a potential suspect in this case. In 2021, a series of articles were written in the North York Inquirer by journalist Tim Hicks and retired police intelligence officer and cold case investigator Chris Clark. Their focus was on linking convicted killer Christopher Halliwell to other unsolved murders around the UK. On October 19th, 2012, at Bristol Crown Court, Christopher Halliwell, 48, pleaded guilty to the murder of 22-year-old Sian O'Callaghan. Sian disappeared from Swindon, Wiltshire, having last been seen at a nightclub in the town in the early hours of March 19, 2011. Her body was found on March 24, 2011, near Effington in Oxfordshire. It came to light that a second murder charge against Halliwell had been dropped as a result of an error in the police handling of the case. The body of Becky Godden Edwards, a woman who had been reported missing in 2007, was found after Halliwell's arrest. Halliwell actually led police to the body. As Detective Superintendent Steve Fulcher had breached the guidelines of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984 by failing to caution Halliwell and denying him access to a solicitor during the period the confessions were obtained, the judge deemed that they were inadmissible in court.
Yeah, I found that crazy that Christopher Halliwell actually led the police to Becky's body. Well, obviously, okay, they're supposed to read out their rights, but he led them to her body. Don't understand that.
I think it was the BBC did a really good dramatisation of it with Martin Freeman as Fulcher, probably about 5 or 6 years ago. It might be around on iPlayer still. It's really good. It was very good to kind of get into that case, and Martin Freeman was really good in it, so yeah.
Did it make sense why they had to throw
that? Yeah, it does, yeah. And I've kind of condensed a lot of it here just to make it fit into the narrative, but because it was complicated. And basically the following years were full of legal wrangling, and Detective Superintendent Fulcher resigned from the force in 2014 after being found guilty of gross misconduct for not following proper procedures when arresting Halliwell. But by 2016, enough evidence had been uncovered and Halliwell was charged with Becky Godden Edwards' murder, and he was found guilty of the crime. Unfortunately, Christopher Halliwell has popped up in quite a few of the episodes I've done for Unsolved Murders in the UK, as we will see in a minute, basically. So Fulcher maintains that Halliwell is a serial killer. There was an 8-year gap between the murders of Becky and Sian, and he is convinced there are other victims during this period and possibly before. It's unusual for someone like Halliwell to start killing in his 40s. And there are unsolved murders as far back as 1988, when Halliwell would have been in his mid-20s, that have been linked to him. A strong piece of evidence suggesting the serial killer theory is the secret stash containing over 60 items of women's clothes Halliwell had hidden away at a river in Ramsbury, Wiltshire. Items belonging to Sian and Becky were found at this location. Fulcher also says that during a search of Halliwell's house after Sian O'Callaghan's murder, he found 12 pencil-drawn sketches of areas of outstanding beauty. These have not been made public. Do these drawings depict possible burial sites? In a 2016 interview with BBC Radio 4's Today programme, Fulcher claimed that Halliwell said, "Police want to interview me about 8 murders." Chris Clark and Tim Hicks put forward Halliwell as a potential suspect in Anne Herron's murder. They also say there may be a link with a missing persons case that happened just 6 weeks or so before Anne's murder. It's a case I've covered on my own podcast. On Saturday, June 16th, 1990, in Llangollen, North Wales, 52-year-old antiques dealer Trevelyne Evans put a sign on her shop door which read, "Back in 2 minutes." She popped across to a local market stall and purchased some fruit for her lunch. Around an hour later, a witness saw Trevelyne walking near her home, a short distance from her shop. There have been no confirmed sightings of Trevelyne since then. Clark and Hicks believe Trevelyne may well have been murdered by Halliwell. Clark and Hicks note some similarities between the cases of Trevelyne Evans and Anne Herron. Both women were on their own, and the incidents took place in the middle of the day. They happened over sunny summer weekends in a rural location and were near fishing sites, the River Dee and Llangollen Canal in North Wales, and the River Tees in the northeast of England. Halliwell was a keen fisherman and travelled all over the UK to participate in his hobby. A blue 4-door car was reported near the scene in both cases. Clark and Hicks speculate that the theft of antiques could have been the initial reason for the attacks on the women. Trevelyne was an antiques dealer, and perhaps Halliwell viewed Aeolian House as a place he would find expensive trinkets. In their eyes, Halliwell is a good suspect for Anne Heron's murder, because he fits the description of the man seen driving the blue car. In 1990, Halliwell would have been in his mid-20s, but he did look a lot older than his years. The man in the car is described as being 30 to 45. It is believed that in 1990, Halliwell was living in Orton Park, Lancashire. This is around a 2.5 hours drive from Darlington, and about an hour and 20 minutes drive from Llangollen. Clark and Hicks speculate that the lower part of Anne's bikini was taken by Halliwell as a souvenir. He did take trophies after the murders of Becky Godden Edwards and Sian O'Callaghan.
I did read somewhere, though, that Jen Jarvie had said that no trophies were taken from Anne Heron's the murder scene.
Yeah, I think they speculated that, possibly because certainly in the newspaper reports I've read, the police never, although they said that the bikini bottoms were removed, they never said where they were found. So I think that's them speculating. And I think as the police have never officially said, as far as I'm aware, they've just speculated that. But yeah, I don't know if they're working on any information that we don't know or whether it's just pure speculation. Christopher Halliwell's past remains shrouded in mystery as he refuses to talk about any of the crimes he may have committed. For that reason, it is difficult to officially discount him as a suspect in so many unsolved murders around the country, including Anne Heron's.
I've heard vaguely about it. Over the last however many years, it's been 34 years or something like that, you know, various things have come to our notice. And every time I read about serial killer or a killing in that neck of the woods, I always, you know, follow up, have a look at various articles. Halliwell was just another one of those. It's possible, but he's a big name, so he's going to draw more attention, I guess. I've got every faith in the police at Darlington that if there is anything substantial there, then they will have a look at it. I mean, at the end of the day, I guess as time has passed, DNA has evolved. And there's always a chance there that something might come through DNA, but who knows? Who knows?
In August 2023, Durham Police issued a fresh appeal for information in Anne's case, saying they would continue to use technological advances to review forensic evidence in the case. DCI Craig Redd of Durham Constabulary Major Crime Team said the case was still open.
I don't hold a flag for the police. I've had run-ins as a reporter, professionally, not like I'm not in trouble with the police, you know, but professionally I've been involved and colleagues of mine have been involved with the police using powers to book telephones of journalists. And there's quite a few things I've had trouble professionally with the police. So I'm not the kind of person who's police right or wrong. Sometimes the police can be wrong, but I will say that with a murder inquiry, the police do take that very, very, very seriously. And because I'm reading a lot of the talk today about, they haven't done the job properly. Maybe they didn't, but it won't have been because they didn't care. You know, I mean, I will say, and as I say, I say that as somebody who doesn't necessarily hold a flag waving for the police.
Yeah, I certainly think that everybody in life makes mistakes, not just police officers. Everybody makes mistakes. So I don't think it's perfect. I don't think the investigation was flawless, but I certainly think that they have done a thorough investigation. I've kept in touch with them all of these years, now less frequently, but I do talk to them once or twice a year. Whoever the SIO is, the senior investigating officer, I'll speak to at least twice a year, usually on the anniversary, and then at some other point during the year. But yeah, it's still open. We're still hoping. And I take every opportunity, including this one. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about it, because we want to just get it out there. And you know, if there's somebody, if it reaches somebody out there that hasn't been reached before, that's got any information whatsoever that they can come forward to, get in touch with you guys, get in touch with me, whatever. That would be fabulous.
Over the years, Durham Police, though they have investigated many individuals, and some remain of interest. Police say Peter Heron was designated a suspect in 2005, and this status has not changed. When Peter was asked outright in front of TV cameras, "Did you kill Anne Heron?" he answered with an unequivocal no. The Heron family and Anne's family have had no contact with each other since about a week after the murder. Although Anne's son Ralph said in the Channel 5 documentary that he would like to have a conversation with Peter to talk about what happened.
I have been in touch with various people since it happened. I've spoken to criminologists, I've spoken to the police, I've spoken to various people, and I've offered several times to have a conversation with Peter, and he's not taken me up on that at any point. I was invited down to his daughter Dawn's house. This has got to be, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. Dawn had said to me, because Dawn clearly, you know, she's looking after her dad, and Dawn wanted to prove to me that Peter wasn't involved in any way. And she said to me, come down, see us, spend the night, and we can show you what we've got and talk you through it. And I said, fabulous, brilliant. Is Peter going to be there? And she said, no, he doesn't want to see you. He's going. So I went down, went through with Dawn what she had, and I left there. And I remember leaving there and saying to Dawn as I left that, yeah, seen what you've got to say, seen the documentation and everything that you've got, but still doesn't change my mind either way. So, and that was it from there on. Spoke to his daughter a couple of times since then, and we've been to see the police at Darlington when Michael Benson came up as a potential suspect or potential person of interest. We went to see the police in Durham, and Dawn, his daughter, was there, and I was there as well. So I spoke to her on that occasion, because clearly we both had a vested interest in the police taking an active interest in Michael Benson. Having a look at him, who's a person of interest, from my point of view, he had to be eliminated. You know, got to look at him, eliminate him, move him away and carry on, or look at him, get some evidence and not convict the guy because he was dead at that point, but at least get something to indicate that it was him. The police obviously looked at that, haven't come up with anything from that line of inquiry. And I think that was probably the last time that I spoke to Peter or his daughter. I just got the impression that he thought that I thought he had killed him, which I'd never said to him. And I never have said that. The only thing I've ever said about who killed my mum was the only person I know who wasn't 100% was me, you know. That's it. And until anybody comes up with definitive evidence either way, then guess we'll never know.
If you have information about the 1990 murder of Anne Heron, you can contact Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111 or call the Durham Police via 101.
I would just ask anybody that thinks they have got anything, no matter how insignificant, anything that they think might be relevant, to come forward. Let the police at Darlington know, call Crime Stoppers. It can be anonymous, because I'd like to know why. I mean, that's the answer that I need answered, is why. You know, I don't know who it is. You know, I said at the time with absolute certainty, 100% certainty, the only person I knew hadn't done it was me. So, yeah, there are people of interest. There are people who are suspected. They're still there. They haven't been eliminated. So it might just be that final piece of the jigsaw that we're waiting on to help solve it.